Ding ding, room for one more. And you can't beat that for an offer. You can't fight it. Marcus and Majid. Majid and Marcus. Nothing else mattered. The two of them were oblivious to the upset they caused Irie, or to the widespread displacement, the strange seismic ripples that their friendship had set off in everyone else. Marcus had pulled out, like Mountbatten from India, or a satiated teenage boy from his latest mate. He abrogated responsibility for everything and everybody, Chalfans, Iqbals, and Joneses, everything and everyone bar Majid and his mice. All others were fanatics, and Irie bit her tongue because Majid was good, and Majid was kind, and Majid walked through the house in white. But like all manifestations of the Second Coming, all saints, saviors, and gurus, Majid Iqbal was also, in Nina's eloquent words, a first-class, 100% bona fide, total and utter pain in the arse. A typical conversation. Irie, I am confused. Not right now, Majid, I'm on the phone. I don't wish to take from your valuable time, but it is a matter of some urgency. I am confused. Majid, could you just... You see, Joyce very kindly bought me these jeans. They are called Levi's. Look, could I call you back? Right. Okay, bye. What, Majid? That was an important call. What is it? So you see, I have these beautiful American Levi jeans, white jeans, that Joyce's sister brought back from a holiday in Chicago, the Windy City, they call it. Though I don't believe there is anything particularly unusual about its climate, considering its proximity to Canada. My Chicago jeans, such a thoughtful gift, I was overwhelmed to receive them. But then I was confused by this label in the inner lining that states that the jeans are apparently shrink to fit. I asked myself, what can this mean? Shrink to fit. They shrink until they fit, Majid. That would be my guess. But Joyce was percipient enough to buy them in precisely the right size, you see, a 32-34. All right, Majid, I don't want to see them, I believe you, so don't shrink them. That was my original conclusion also. But it appears there is no separate procedure for shrinking them. If one washes the jeans, they will simply shrink. Fascinating. And you appreciate at some juncture the jeans will require washing. What's your point, Majid? Well, do they shrink by some pre-calculated amount, and if so, by how much? If the amount was not correct, they would open themselves up to a great deal of litigation, no? It is no good if they shrink to fit, after all, if they do not shrink to fit me. There is another possibility, as Jack suggested, that they shrink to the contours of the body. Yet how can such a thing be possible? Well, why don't you get in the fucking bath with the fucking jeans on and see what happens? But you couldn't upset Majid with words. He turned the other cheek, sometimes hundreds of times a day, like a lollipop lady on ecstasy. He had this way of smiling at you, neither wounded nor angry, and then inclining his head to the exact same angle his father did when taking an order of curried prawns, in a gesture of total forgiveness. He had absolute empathy for everybody, Majid, and it was an unbelievable pain in the arse. I didn't mean to... Oh, shit. Sorry. Look, I don't know. You're just so... Have you heard from Milat? My brother shuns me, said Majid, that same expression of universal calm and forgiveness unchanged. He marks me like Cain because I'm a non-believer, at least not in his God or any others with a name. Because of this, he refuses to meet me, even to talk on the telephone. Oh, you know, he'll probably come round. He always was a stubborn bastard. Of course, yes, you love him, continued Majid, not giving Irie a chance to protest. So you know his habits, his manners. You will understand, then, how fiercely he takes my conversion. I have converted to life. I see his God in the millionth position of pi, in the arguments of the Phaedrus in a perfect paradox. But that is not enough for Milat. Irie looked him square in the face. There was something in there she had been unable to put her finger on these 4 months. Because it was obscured by his youth, his looks, his clean clothes and his personal hygiene. Now she saw it clearly. He was touched by it, the same as Mad Mary, the Indian with the white face and the blue lips and the guy who carried his wig around on a piece of string. The same as those people who walked the Willesden streets with no intention of buying Black Label beer or stealing a stereo, collecting the dole or pissing in an alleyway. The ones with a wholly different business, prophecy. and Majid had it in his face. He wanted to tell you, and tell you, and tell you. Milat demands complete surrender. Sounds typical. He wants me to join Keepers of the Eternal and, yeah, Kevin. I know them. So you have spoken to him. I don't need to speak to him to know what he thinks. He is my twin. I don't wish to see him. I don't need to. Do you understand the nature of twins? Do you understand the meaning of the word cleave? Or rather the double meaning that Majid... No offense, but I've got work to do. Majid gave a little bow. Naturally, you will excuse me. I have to go and submit my Chicago genes to the experiment you proposed. Irie gritted her teeth, picked up the phone and redialed the number she had cut off. It was a journalist. It was always journalists these days. And she had something to read to him. She'd had a crash course in media relations since her exams, and dealing with them, it had taught her there was no point in trying to deal with each one separately. To give some unique point of view to the FT and then to the Mirror and then to the Daily Mail was impossible. It was their job, not yours, to get the angle to write their separate book of the huge media Bible, each to their own. Reporters were factional, fanatical, obsessively defending their own turf, propounding the same thing day after day. So it had always been. Who would have guessed that Luke and John would take such different angles on the scoop of the century, the death of the Lord? It just went to prove that you couldn't trust these guys. Irie's job, then, was to give the information as it stood, every time, verbatim, from a piece of paper written by Marcus and Majid stapled to the wall. All right, said the journo, tape's running. And here Irie stumbled at the first hurdle of PR, believing in what you sell. It wasn't that she lacked the moral faith, it was more fundamental than that. She didn't believe in it as a physical fact. She didn't believe it existed. Future Mouse copyright was now such an enormous, spectacular cartoon of an idea. In every paper's column, agonized over by journos, should it get a patent? Eulogized by hacks, greatest achievement of the century. One expected the damn mouse to stand up and speak by itself. Irie took a deep breath. Though she had repeated the words many times, they still seemed fantastical, absurd. Fiction on the wings of fantasy, with more of a dash of Surrey T. Banks in them. Press release, 15th of October 1992. Subject, launch of Future Mouse. Professor Marcus Chalfen, writer, celebrated scientist and leading figure of a group of research geneticists from St. Jude's College, intends to launch his latest design in a public space to increase understanding of transgenics and to raise interest and further investment in his work. The design will demonstrate the sophistication of the work being done on gene manipulation and demystify this much maligned branch of biological research. It will be accompanied by a full exhibition, a lecture hall, a multimedia area, and interactive games for children. It will be funded in part by the government's Millennial Science Commission with additional monies from business and industry. A two-week-old Future Mouse is to be put on display at the Perret Institute in London on the 31st of December 1992. There it will remain on public display until the 31st of December 1999. This mouse is genetically normal except for a select group of novel genes that are added to the genome. A DNA clone of these genes is injected into the fertilized mouse egg, thus linking them to the chromosomal DNA in the zygote, which is subsequently inherited by cells of the resulting embryo. Before injection into the germline, these genes are custom designed so they can be turned on and expressed only in specific mouse tissue and along a predictable timetable. The mouse will be the site for an experiment into the aging of cells, the progression of cancer within cells, and a few other matters that will serve as surprises along the way. The journalist laughed. Jesus, what the fuck does that mean? I don't know, said Irie. Surprises, I guess, she continued. The mouse will live the 7 years it is on display, roughly double the normal life expectancy of a mouse. The mouse development is retarded, therefore at a ratio of 2 years for every one. At the end of the first year, the SV40 large T oncogene, which the mouse carries in the insulin-producing pancreas cells, will express itself in pancreatic carcinomas that will continue to develop at a retarded pace throughout its life. At the end of the second year, the HRAS oncogene in its skin cells will begin to express itself in multiple benign papillomas that an observer will be able to see clearly 3 months later with the naked eye. 4 years into the experiment, the mouse will begin to lose its ability to produce melanin by means of a slow programmed eradication of the enzyme tyrosinase. At this point, the mouse will lose all its pigmentation and become albino, a white mouse. If no external or unexpected interference occurs, the mouse will live until 31st of December 1999, dying within the month after that date. The Future Mouse experiment offers the public a unique opportunity to see a life and death in close up. The opportunity to witness for themselves a technology that might yet slow the progress of disease, control the process of aging, and eliminate genetic defect. The Future Mouse holds out the tantalizing promise of a new phase in human history, where we are not victims of the random, but instead directors and arbitrators of our own fate. Bloody hell, said the journo, scary shit. Yeah, I guess, said Irie vacantly. She had 10 more calls to make this morning. Do you want me to post on some of the photographic material? Yeah, go on, save me going through the archive, cheers. Just as Irie put down the phone, Joyce flew into the room like a hippie comet, a great stream of black-fringed velvet caftan and multiple silk scarves. Don't use the phone. I've told you before, we've got to keep the phone free. Millat might be trying to ring. 4 days earlier, Millat had missed a psychiatrist's appointment Joyce had arranged for him. He had not been seen since. Everyone knew he was with Kevin, and everyone knew he had no intention of ringing Joyce. Everyone except Joyce. It's simply essential that I talk with him if he rings. We're so close to a breakthrough. Marjorie's almost certain it's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And how come you know all this? I thought Marjorie was a doctor. What the fuck happened to doctor-patient privilege? Oh, Irie, don't be silly. She's a friend too. She's just trying to keep me informed. Middle-class mafia, more like. Oh, really? Don't be so hysterical. You're getting more hysterical by the day. Look, I need you to keep off the phone. I know, you said. Because if Marjorie's right, and it is ADD, he really needs to get to a doctor and some methylphenidate. It's a very debilitative condition. Joyce, he hasn't got a disorder, he's just a Muslim. There are 1 billion of them. They can't all have ADD. Joyce took in a little gasp of air. I think you're being very cruel. That's exactly the kind of comment that isn't helpful. She stalked over to the breadboard, tearfully cut off a huge lump of cheese and said, look, the most important thing is that I get the two of them to face each other. It's time. Irie looked dubious. Why is it time? Joyce popped the lump of cheese into her mouth. It's time because they need each other. But if they don't want to, they don't want to. Sometimes people don't know what they want. They don't know what they need. Those boys need each other like... Joyce thought for a moment. She was bad with metaphor. In a garden you never planted something where something else was meant to be. They need each other like Laurel and Hardy, like Crick needed Watson, like East Pakistan needed West Pakistan. Well, I don't think that's very funny, Irie. I'm not laughing, Joyce. Joyce cut more cheese from the block, tore two hunks of bread from a loaf, and sandwiched the three together. The fact is, these boys have serious emotional problems, and it's not helped by Millat refusing to see Majid. It upsets him so much. They've been split by their religions, by their cultures. Can you imagine the trauma? Irie wished at that moment she had allowed Majid to tell her, to tell her, to tell her. She would at least have had information. She would have had something to use against Joyce. Because if you listen to prophets, they give you ammunition. The nature of twins, the millionth position of pi, do infinite numbers of beginnings, and most of all, the double meaning of the word cleave. Did he know which was worse, which more traumatic, pulling together or tearing apart? Joyce, why don't you worry about your own family for once? Just for a change. What about Josh? When's the last time you saw Josh? Joyce's upper lip stiffened. Josh is in Glastonbury. Right, Glastonbury's been over 2 months, Joyce. Well, he's doing a little travelling. He said he might. And who's he with? You don't know anything about those people. Why don't you worry about that for a while and keep the fuck out of everybody else's business? Joyce didn't even flinch at this. It is hard to explain just how familiar teenage abuse was to Joyce. She got it so regularly these days from her own children and other people's that a swear word or a cruel comment just couldn't affect her. She simply weeded them out. "The reason I don't worry about Josh, as you well know," said Joyce, smiling broadly and speaking in her Chalfen Guide to Parenting voice, "is because he's just trying to get a little bit of attention, rather like you are at this moment. It's perfectly natural for well-educated middle-class children to act up at his age." And like many others around this time, Joyce felt no shame about using the term middle-class. In a Chalfen lexicon, the middle classes were the inheritors of the Enlightenment, the creators of the welfare state, the intellectual elite, and the source of all culture. Where they got this idea, it's hard to say. But they soon come back into the fold. "I'm perfectly confident about Joshua. He's just acting up against his father and it will pass. But Majid has some real problems. I've been doing my research, Irie, and there are just so many signs. I can read them." "Well, you must be misreading them," Irie shot back, because a battle was about to begin. She could sense it. "Majid's fine. I was just talking to him. He's a Zen master. He's the most fucking serene individual I've ever met in my life. He's working with Marcus, which is what he wants to do, and he's happy. How about we all try a policy of non-involvement for once? A little laissez-faire. Majid's fine." "Irie, darling," said Joyce, moving Irie along one chair and positioning herself next to the phone. "What you never understand is that people are extreme. It would be wonderful if everyone was like your father, carrying on as normal, even if the ceiling's coming down around his ears. But a lot of people can't do that. Majid and Milat display extreme behavior. It's all very well saying laissez-faire and being terribly clever about it, but the bottom line is Milat's going to get himself into terrible trouble with these fundamentalist people. Terrible trouble. I hardly sleep for worrying about him. You read about these groups in the news, and it's putting a terrible mental strain on Majid. Now, am I meant to just sit back and watch them tear themselves apart just because their parents... No, I will say it because it's true. Just because their parents don't seem concerned. I've only ever had those boys' welfare at heart. You of all people should know that. They need help. I just walk past the bathroom and Majid is sitting in the bath with his jeans on." "Yes, all right. Now," said Joyce, serene as a bovine. "I should think I know a traumatized child when I see one." 17. Crisis Talks and 11th Hour Tactics. "Mrs. Iqbal, it's Joyce Chalfen. Mrs. Iqbal, I can see you quite clearly. It's Joyce. I really think we should talk. Could you, open the door?" Yes, she could. Theoretically, she could. But in this atmosphere of extremity, with warring suns and disparate factions, Alsana needed a tactic of her own. She'd done silence and word strikes and food consumption, the opposite of a hunger strike. One gets bigger in order to intimidate the enemy. And now she was attempting a sit-down protest. "Mrs. Iqbal, just 5 minutes of your time. Majid's really very upset about all of this. He's worried about Milat, and so am I. Just 5 minutes. Mrs. Iqbal, please." Alsana didn't rise from her seat. She simply continued along the hem, keeping her eye on the black thread as it shuttled from one cog to the next and down into the PVC, pressing the pedal of the singer furiously as if kicking the flank of a horse she wished to ride into the sunset. "Well, you may as well let her in," said Samad wearily, emerging from the lounge, where Joyce's persistence had disturbed his appreciation of the Antiques Roadshow, aside from the Equalizer starring that great moral arbiter, Edward Woodward. It was Samad's favourite programme. He had spent 15 long televisual years waiting for some cockney housewife to pull a trinket of Mangal Pandies out of her handbag. "Oh, Mrs. Winterbottom, now this is very exciting. What we have here is the barrel of the musket belonging to..." He sat with the phone under his right hand so that in the event of such a scenario, he could phone the BBC and demand the said Winterbottom's address and asking price. So far, only mutiny medals and a pocket watch belonging to Havelock, but still he watched. He peered down the hallway at the shadowy form of Joyce through the glass and scratched his testicles sadly. Samad was in his television mode, garish V-neck, stomach swelling like a tight hot water bottle beneath it, long moth-eaten dressing gown, and a pair of paisley boxer shorts from which two stick legs, the legacy of his youth, protruded. In his television mode, action escaped him. The box in the corner of the room, which he liked to think of as an antique of its kind, encased in wood and on four legs like some Victorian robot, sucked him in and sapped all energy. "Well, why don't you do something, Mr. Iqbal? Make her go away instead of standing there with your flabby gut and your tiny willy on display." Samad grunted and tucked the cause of all his troubles, two huge hairy balls and a defeated-looking limp prick, back into the inner lining of his shorts. "She won't go away," he murmured, "and if she does, she will only return with reinforcements." "But why? Hasn't she caused enough trouble?" said Alsana, loudly, loud enough for Joyce. "She has her own family, no? Why does she not go and, for a change, mess them up? She has boys? Four boys? How many boys does she want? How bloody many?" Samad shrugged, went into the kitchen drawer and fished out the earphones that could be plugged into the television and thus short-circuit the outside world. He, like Marcus, had disengaged. "Leave them," was his feeling. "Leave them to their battles." "Oh, thank you," said Alsana caustically, as her husband retreated to his Hugh Scully and his pots and guns. "Thank you, Samad Mia, for your oh-so-valuable contribution. This is what the men do. They make the mess, the century ends, and they leave the women to clear up the shit. Thank you, husband." She increased the speed of her sewing, dashing out the seam, progressing down the inner leg, while the sphinx of the letterbox continued to ask unanswerable questions. "Mrs. Iqbal, please can we talk? Is there any reason why we shouldn't talk? Do we have to behave like children?" Alsana began to sing. "Mrs. Iqbal, please! What can this possibly achieve?" Alsana sang louder. "I must tell you," said Joyce, strident as ever, even through three panels of wood and double glazing, "I'm not here for my health. Whether you want me to be involved or not, I am, you see, I am." Involved. At least that was the right word. Alsana reflected as she lifted her foot off the pedal and let the wheel spin a few times alone before coming to a squeaky halt. Sometimes, here in England, especially at bus stops and on the daytime soaps, you heard people say, "We're involved with each other," as if this were a most wonderful state to be in, as if one chose it and enjoyed it. Alsana never thought of it that way. Involved happened over a long period of time, pulling you in like quicksand. Involved is what befell the moon-faced Alsana Begum and the handsome Samad Mia 1 week after they'd been pushed into a deli breakfast room together and informed they were to marry. Involved was the result when Clara Bowden met Archie Jones at the bottom of some stairs. Involved swallowed up a girl called Ambrosia and a boy called Charlie. Yes, Clara had told her that sorry tale. The second they kissed in the larder of a guest house. Involved is neither good nor bad. It is just a consequence of living, a consequence of occupation and immigration, of empires and expansion, of living in each other's pockets. One becomes involved, and it is a long trek back to being uninvolved. And the woman was right. One didn't do it for one's health. Nothing this late in the century was done with health in mind. Alsana was no dummy when it came to the modern condition. She watched the talk shows all day long. She watched the talk shows. "My wife slept with my brother. My mother won't stay out of my boyfriend's life." And the microphone holder, whether it be tanned man with white teeth or scary married couple, always asks the same damn silly question. "But why do you feel the need?" Wrong. Alsana had to explain it to them through the screen. "You blockhead. They are not wanting this. They are not willing it. They are just involved, see? They walk in, and they get trapped between the revolving doors of those two Vs. Involved. The years pass, and the mess accumulates, and here we are. Your brother's sleeping with my ex-wife's niece's second cousin. Involved. Just a tired, inevitable fact. Something in the way Joyce said it. Involved. Wearied, slightly acid, suggested to Alsana that the word meant the same thing to her. An enormous web you spin to catch yourself. "Okay, okay, lady, 5 minutes only. I have 3 cat suits to do this morning, come hell or high water." Alsana opened the door and Joyce walked into the hallway, and for a moment they surveyed their opposite number, guessing each other's weight like nervous prize fighters prior to mounting the scales. They were definitely a match for each other. What Joyce lacked in chest, she made up in bottom. Where Alsana revealed a weakness in delicate features, a thin and pretty nose, light eyebrows, she compensated with the huge pudge of her arms, the dimples of maternal power. For, after all, she was the mother here, the mother of the boys in question. She held the trump card. Should she be forced to play it? Okie dokie then, said Alsana, squeezing through the narrow kitchen door, beckoning Joyce to follow. Is it tea or is it coffee? Tea, said Joyce firmly. Fruit, if possible. Fruit, not possible. Not even Earl Grey is possible. I come from the land of tea to this god-awful country and then I can't afford a proper cup of it. PG tips is possible and nothing else. Joyce winced. PG tips, please, then. As you wish. The mug of tea plonked in front of Joyce a few minutes later, was grey with a rim of scum and thousands of little microbes flitting through it. Less micro than one would have hoped. Alsana gave Joyce a moment to consider it. Just leave it for a while, she explained gaily. My husband hit a water pipe when digging a trench for some onions. Our water is a little funny ever since. It may give you the running shits or it may not, but give it a minute and it clears. See? Alsana gave it an unconvincing stir, sending yet larger chunks of unidentified matter bubbling up to the surface. You see? Fit for Shah Jahan himself. Joyce took a tentative sip and then pushed it to one side. Mrs. Iqbal, I know we haven't been on the best of terms in the past, but Mrs. Chalfen, said Alsana, putting up her long forefinger to stop Joyce speaking. There are two rules that everybody knows, from PM to Jin Rickshawwala. The first is, never let your country become a trading post. Very important. If my ancestors had followed this advice, my situation presently would be very different, but such is life. The second is, don't interfere in other people's family business. Milk? No. No, thank you. A little sugar. Alsana dumped a huge heaped tablespoon into Joyce's cup. You think I'm interfering? I think you have interfered, but I just want the twins to see each other. You are the reason they are apart. But Majid is only living with us because Milat won't live with him here, and Majid tells me your husband can barely stand the sight of him. Alsana, little pressure cooker that she was, blew. And why can't he? Because you and your husband have involved Majid in something so contrary to our culture, to our beliefs, that we barely recognize him. You have done that. He is at odds with his brother now. Impossible conflict. Those green bow-tied bastards. Milat is high up with them now, very involved. He doesn't tell me, but I hear. They call themselves followers of Islam, but they are nothing but thugs in a gang roaming Kilburn, like all the other lunatics, and now they are sending out the, what are they called, folded paper trouble. Leaflets about your husband and his ungodly mouse. Trouble brewing, yes sir, I found them, hundreds of them under his bed. Alsana stood up, drew a key out of her apron pocket, and opened a kitchen cupboard stacked full of green leaflets, which cascaded onto the floor. He's disappeared again, 3 days, I have to put them back before he finds out they're gone. Take some, go on lady, take them, go and read them to Majid, show him what you have done. Two boys driven to different ends of the world. You have made a war between my sons. You are splitting them apart. A minute earlier, Milat had turned the key ever so softly in the front door. Since then, he had been standing in the hallway, listening to the conversation and smoking a fag. It was great. It was like listening to two big Italian matriarchs from opposing clans battle it out. Milat loved clans. He had joined Kevin because he loved clans. And the outfit and the bow tie. And he loved clans at war. Marjorie, the analyst, had suggested that this desire to be part of a clan was a result of being effectively half a twin. Marjorie, the analyst, suggested that Milat's religious conversion was more likely born out of a need for sameness within a group than out of any intellectually formulated belief in the existence of an all-powerful creator. Maybe. Whatever. As far as he was concerned, you could analyze it until the cows came home, but nothing beat being all dressed in black, smoking a fag, listening to two mummers battle it out over you in operatic style. You claim to want to help my boys, but you have done nothing but drive a wedge between them. It is too late now. I have lost my family. Why don't you go back to yours and leave us alone? You think it's paradise over at my house? My family has been split by this too. Joshua isn't speaking to Marcus. Did you know that? And those two were so close. Joyce looked a bit weepy, and Alsana reluctantly passed her the kitchen roll. I'm trying to help all of us, and the best way to start is to get Majid and Milat talking before this escalates any further than it has. I think we can both agree on that. If we could find some neutral place, some ground where they both felt no pressures or outside influence. But there are no neutral places anymore. I agree they should meet, but where and how? You and your husband have made everything impossible. Mrs. Iqbal, with all due respect, the problems in your family began long before either my husband or I had any involvement. Maybe, maybe, Mrs. Chalfen, but you are the salt in the wound, yes? You are the one extra chili pepper in the hot sauce. Milat heard Joyce draw her breath in sharply. Again, with respect, I can't believe that it is the case. I think this has been going on for a very long time. Milat told me that some years ago you burnt all his things. I mean, it's just an example, but I don't think you understand the trauma that kind of thing has inflicted on Milat. He's very damaged. Oh, we are going to play the tit for the tat, I see. And I'm to be the tit. Not that it is any of your big nose business, but I burned those things to teach him a lesson. To respect other people's lives. Strange way of showing it, if you don't mind me saying. I do mind, I do mind. What do you know of it? Only what I see. I see that Milat has a lot of mental scars. You may not be aware, but I've been funding sessions for Milat with my analyst. And I can tell you, Milat's inner life, his karma, I suppose you might call it in Bengali, the whole world of his subconscious shows serious illness. In fact, the problem with Milat's subconscious, and he didn't need Marjorie to tell him this, was that it was basically split level. On the one hand, he was trying real hard to live as Hifan and the others suggested. This involved getting his head around four main criteria. One, to be ascetic in one's habits, cut down on the booze, the spliff, the women. Two, to remember always the glory of Muhammad, peace be upon him, and the might of the Creator. Three, to grasp a full intellectual understanding of Kevin and the Quran. Four, to purge oneself of the taint of the West. He knew that he was Kevin's big experiment, and he wanted to give it his best shot. In the first three areas, he was doing fine. He smoked the odd fag and put away a Guinness on occasion. Can't say fairer than that. But he was very successful with both the evil weed and the temptations of the flesh. He no longer saw Alexandra Andrusier, Polly Houghton or Rosie Dew, though he paid occasional visits to one Tanya Chapman, a very small redhead who understood the delicate nature of his dilemma and would give him a thorough blowjob without requiring Milat to touch her at all. It was a mutually beneficial arrangement. She was a daughter of a judge and delighted in horrifying the old goat, and Milat needed ejaculation with no actual active participation on his side. On the scriptural side of things, he thought Muhammad, peace be upon him, was a right geezer, a great bloke, and he was in awe of the Creator. In the original meaning of that word, dread, fear, really shit scared, and Hifan said that was correct. That was how it should be. He understood this idea that his religion was not one based on faith. Not like the Christians, the Jews et al., but one that could be intellectually proved by the best minds. He understood the idea, but sadly, Milat was far from possessing one of the best minds, or even a reasonable mind. Intellectual proof or disproof was beyond him. Still, he understood that to rely on faith, as his own father did, was contemptible, and no one could say he didn't give 100% to the cause. That seemed enough for Kevin. They were more than happy with his real forte, which was the delivery of the thing, the presentation. For instance, if a nervous-looking woman came up to the Kevin stall in Willesden Library and asked about the faith, Milat would lean over the desk, grab her hand, press it and say, "Not faith, sister. We do not deal in faith here. Spend 5 minutes with my brother Rakesh and he will intellectually prove to you the existence of the Creator. The Quran is a document of science, a document of rational thought. Spend 5 minutes, sister, if you care for your future beyond this earth." And to top it off, he could usually sell her a few tapes. Ideological warfare, or let the scholars beware, £2 each, or even some of their literature if he was on top form. Everyone at Kevin was mightily impressed, so far so good. As for Kevin's more unorthodox programs of direct action, Milat was right in there. He was their greatest asset. He was in the forefront, the first into battle come jihad. Call us fuck in a crisis. A man of action. Like Brando. Like Pacino. Like Leota. But even as Milat reflected on this with pride in his mother's hallway, his heart sank. For therein lay the problem. Number 4. Purging oneself of the West. Now he knew that if you wanted an example of the moribund, decadent, degenerate, oversexed, violent state of Western capitalist culture and the logical endpoint of its obsession with personal freedoms, leaflet, Way Out West, you couldn't do much better than Hollywood cinema. And he knew, how many times had he been through it with Hirfan, that the gangster movie, the mafia genre, was the worst example of that. And yet, it was the hardest thing to let go. He would give every spliff he'd ever smoked and every woman he'd ever fucked to retrieve the films his mother had burnt, or even the few he had purchased more recently which Hirfan had confiscated. He had torn up his Rocky video membership and thrown away the Iqbal video recorder to distance himself from direct temptation. But was it his fault if Channel 4 ran a De Niro season? Could he help it if Tony Bennett's rags to riches floated out of a clothes shop and entered his soul? It was his most shameful secret that whenever he opened a door, a car door, a car boot, the door of Kevin's meeting hall, or the door of his own house just now, the opening of Goodfellas ran through his head, and he found this sentence rolling around in what he presumed was his subconscious. As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. He even saw it like that, in that font, like on the movie poster. And when he found himself doing it, he tried desperately not to. He tried to fix it, but Milat's mind was a mess, and more often than not, he'd end up pushing open the door, head back, shoulders forward, Leota style, thinking, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a Muslim. He knew, in a way, this was worse, but he just couldn't help it. He kept a white handkerchief in his top pocket. He always carried dice, even though he had no idea what a crap game actually was. He loved long camel jackets, and he could cook a killer seafood linguine. Though a lamb curry was completely beyond him. It was all haram, he knew that. Worst of all was the anger inside him, not the righteous anger of a man of God, but the seething violent anger of a gangster. A juvenile delinquent, determined to prove himself, determined to run the clan, determined to beat the rest. And if the game was God, if the game was a fight against the West, against the presumptions of Western science, against his brother or Marcus Chalfen, he was determined to win it. Milat stubbed his fag out against the banister. It pissed him off that these were not pious thoughts. But they were in the right ballpark, weren't they? He had the fundamentals, didn't he? Clean living, praying 5 times a day without fail, fasting, working for the cause, spreading the message, and that was enough, wasn't it? Maybe. Whatever. Either way, there was no going back now. Yeah, he'd meet Majid. He'd meet him. They'd have a good face-off. He'd come out of it the stronger. He'd call his brother a little cockroach and walk out of that tete-a-tete even more determined to fulfill his destiny. Milat straightened his green bow tie and slunk forward like Leota, all menace and charm, and pushed open the kitchen door. Ever since I can remember, waiting for 2 pairs of eyes like 2 of Scorsese's cameras to pan onto his face and focus. Milat! Amma? Milat! Joyce. Great, superb, so we all know each other, went Melet's inner monologue in Paul Savino's voice. Now let's get down to business. All right, gentlemen, there is no reason to be alarmed. It is simply my son, Majid. Mickey. Mickey, Majid. O'Connell's once more, because Alsana had eventually conceded Joyce's point, but did not care to dirty her hands. Instead, she demanded Samad take Majid out somewhere and spend an evening persuading him into meeting with Milat. But the only out Samad understood was O'Connell's, and the prospect of taking his son there was repellent. He and his wife had a thorough wrestle in the garden to settle the point, and he was confident of success until Alsana fooled him with the dummy trip, then an armlock knee groin combination. So here he was, O'Connell's, and it was as bad a choice as he'd suspected. When he, Archie and Majid walked in, trying to make a low-key entrance, there had been widespread consternation amongst both staff and clientele. The last stranger anybody remembered arriving with Arch and Sam was Samad's accountant, a small rat-faced man who tried to talk to people about their savings, as if people in O'Connell's had savings, and asked not once but twice for blood pudding, though it had been explained to him that pig was unavailable. That had been around 1987, and nobody had enjoyed it. And now what was this? A mere 5 years later, and here comes another one, this time all dressed in white, insultingly clean for a Friday evening in O'Connell's, and way below the unspoken minimum age requirement, 36. What was Samad trying to do? "What are you trying to do to us, Sammy?" asked Johnny, a mournful-looking stick of an ex-orange man who was leaning over the hot plate to collect some bubble and squeak. "Overrun us, are ya, or something?"
"Who, him?"
demanded Denzil, who had not yet died. "Your batty boy," inquired Clarence, who was also, by God's grace, hanging on in there. "All right, gentlemen, there is no reason to be alarmed. It is simply my son, Majid, Mickey. Mickey, Majid." Mickey looked a little dumbfounded by this introduction and just stood there for a minute, a soggy fried egg hanging off his spatula. "Majid, Mahfuz, Murshed, Mubtizim, Iqbal," said Majid serenely. "It is a great honour to meet you, Michael. I have heard such a great deal about you." Which was odd, because Samad had never told him a thing. Mickey continued to look over Majid's shoulder to Samad for confirmation.
"You what? You mean the one you were sent back home? This is Majid?"
"Yes, yes, this is Majid," replied Samad rapidly, pissed off by all the attention the boy was getting. "Now, Archibald and I will have our usuals, and..."
"Majid Iqbal," repeated Mickey slowly. "Well, I bloody never. You know, you'd never guess he was an Iqbal. You've got a very trusting, well, kind of sympathetic face, if you get me."
"And yet I am an Iqbal, Michael," said Majid, laying that look of total empathy on Mickey and the other dregs of humanity huddled around the hot counter. "Though I have been gone a long time."
"Say that again. Well, this is a turn up for the books. I've got your... wait a minute, let me get this right. Your great-great-grandfather up there, see?
I noticed it the moment I came in, and I can assure you, Michael, my soul is very grateful for it," said Majid, beaming like an angel. "It makes me feel at home, and as this place is dear to my father and his friend, Archibald Jones, I feel certain it shall also be dear to me. They have brought me here, I think, to discuss important matters, and I for one can think of no better place for them, despite your clearly debilitating skin condition." Mickey was simply bowled over by that and could not conceal his pleasure, addressing his reply both to Majid and the rest of O'Connell's.
"Speaks fucking nice, doesn't he? Sounds like a right fucking Olivier. Queen's fucking English and no mistake. What a nice fella. You're the kind of clientele I could do with in here. Majid, let me tell you, civilized and that. And don't you worry about my skin. It don't get anywhere near the food and it don't give me much trouble. Cough, what a gentleman. You do feel like you should watch your mouth around him, don't you?"
"Mine and Archibald's usual then, please, Mickey," said Samad. "I'll leave my son to make up his mind. We will be over by the pinball."
"Yeah, yeah," said Mickey, not bothering or able to turn his gaze from Majid's dark eyes.
"That a lovely suit you got there," murmured Denzel, stroking the white linen wistfully. "That's what the Englishman used to wear back home in Jamaica. Remember that, Clarence?" Clarence nodded slowly, dribbling a little, struck by the beatific.
"Go on, get out of it, the pair of you," grumbled Mickey, shooing them away. "I'll bring it over, all right? I want to talk to Majid here. Growing boy, he's got to eat."
"So, what is it I can get you, Majid?" Mickey leant over the counter, all concerned, like an over-attentive shop girl. "Eggs, mushrooms, beans, fried slice?"
"I think," replied Majid, slowly surveying the dusty chalkboard menus on the wall, and then turning back to Mickey, his face illumined. "I should like a bacon sandwich."
"Yes, that is it. I would love a juicy yet well-done tomato ketchuped bacon sandwich on brown." Oh, the struggle that could be seen on Mickey's kisser at that moment. Oh, the gargoylian contortions. It was a battle between the favour of the most refined customer he had ever had and the most hallowed sacred rule of O'Connell's pool house, no pork. Mickey's left eye twitched.
"Well, don't want a nice plate of scrambled. I do a lovely scrambled eggs, don't I, Johnny?"
"I'd be a liar if I said you didn't," said Johnny loyally from his table. "Even though Mickey's eggs were famously grey and stiff, I'd be a terrible liar on my mother's life, I would." Majid wrinkled his nose and shook his head. "All right, what about mushrooms and beans? Omelette and chips? No better chips in the Finchley Road. Come on, son." He pleaded desperate. "You're a Muslim, ain't ya? You don't want to break your father's heart with a bacon sandwich." My father's heart will not be broken by a bacon sandwich. It is far more likely that my father's heart will break from the result of a build-up of saturated fat, which is in turn a result of eating in your establishment for 15 years. One wonders, said Majid evenly, if a case could be made, a legal case, you understand, against individuals in the food service industry who failed to label their meals with a clear fat content or general health warning. One wonders. All this was delivered in the sweetest, most melodious voice, and with no hint of threat. Poor Mickey didn't know what to make of it. Well, of course, said Mickey nervously. Hypothetically, that is an interesting question. Very interesting. Yes, I think so. Yeah, definitely. Mickey fell silent and spent a minute elaborately polishing the top of the hot plate, an activity he indulged in about once every 10 years. There. See your face in that? Now, where were we? A bacon sandwich. At the sound of the word bacon, a few ears began to twitch at the front tables. If you could keep your voice down a little. A bacon sandwich, whispered Majid. Bacon, right. Well, I'll have to nip next door because I ain't got none at present. But you just sit down with your dad and I'll bring it over. It'll cost a bit more, like, what with the extra effort, you know, but don't worry, I'll bring it over. And tell Archie not to worry if he ain't got the cash. A luncheon voucher will do. You are very kind, Michael. Take one of these. Majid reached into his pocket and pulled out a piece of folded paper. Ah, fuck me, another leaflet. You can't fucking move, pardon my French, but you can't move for leaflets in North London these days. My brother Abdul Collins is always loading me with them and all, but seeing as it's you, go on, hand it over. It's not a leaflet, said Majid, collecting his knife and fork from the tray. It's an invitation to a launch. You what? Said Mickey excitedly, in the grammar of his daily tabloid. Launch means lots of cameras, expensive-looking birds with huge tits, red carpets. Really? Millat passed him the invite. Incredible things are to be seen and heard there. Oh, said Mickey, disappointed, eyeing the expensive piece of card. I've heard about this bloke and his mouse. He had heard about this bloke and his mouse in the same tabloid. It was a kind of filler between the tits and the more tits, and it was underneath the byline, one bloke and his mouse. Seems a bit dodgy to me, messing with God and all that. Besides, I ain't that scientifically minded, you see. Go right over my head. Oh, I don't think so. One just has to look at the thing from a perspective that interests you personally. Take your skin, for example. I wish somebody would fucking take it, joked Mickey amiably. I've had a fucking enough of it. Majid did not smile. You suffer from a serious endocrine disorder, by which I mean it is not simply adolescent acne caused by the over-excretion of sebum, but a condition that comes from a hormonal defect. I presume your family share it? Yeah, as it happens. All my brothers and my son, Abdul Jimmy, all spotty bastards. But you would not like it if your son were to pass on the condition to his sons. Obviously, no, I had terrible trouble in school. I carry a knife to this day, Majid, but I can't see how that can be avoided, to be honest with you. Been going on for decades. But you see, said Majid, and what an expert he was at the personal interest angle, it can certainly be avoided. It would be perfectly simple and much misery would be saved. That is the kind of thing we will be discussing at the launch. Oh, well, if that's the case, you know, count me in. I thought it was just some bloody mutant mouse or something, you see. But if that's the case, 31st December, said Majid, before walking down the aisle to his father. It'll be wonderful to see you there. You took your time, said Archie, as Majid approached their table. Did you come by via the Ganges? Inquired Samad, irritably, shifting up to make space for him. Pardon me, please. I was just speaking with your friend, Michael. A very decent chap. Oh, before I forget, Archibald, he said that it would be perfectly acceptable to pay in luncheon vouchers this evening. Archie almost choked on a little toothpick he was chewing on. He said what? Are you sure? Quite sure. Now, Abba, shall we begin? There's nothing to begin, growled Samad, refusing to look him in the eye. I am afraid we are already far into whatever diabolic plot fate has in store for me, and I want you to know that I am not here of my own volition, but because your mother begged me to do this and because I have more respect for that poor woman than either you or your brother ever had. Majid released a wry, gentle smile. I thought you were here because Amma beat you in the wrestling. Samad scowled. Oh yes, ridicule me, my own son. Do you never read the Quran? Do you not know the duties a son owes to his father? You sicken me, Majid Muptism. Oi, Sammy. Old man, said Archie, playing with the ketchup, trying to keep things light. Steady on. No, I will not steady on. This boy is a thorn in my foot.
surely sighed. Archibald, stay out of this. Archie returned his attention to the pepper and salt cellars, trying to pour the former into the latter. Right you are, Sam. I have a message to deliver, and I will deliver it and no more. Majid, your mother wants you to meet with Milat. The woman Chalfon will arrange it. It is their opinion that the two of you must talk. And what is your opinion, Abba? You don't want to hear my opinion. On the contrary, Abba, I would very much like to hear it. Simply, I think it is a mistake. I think you two can do no possible good for each other. I think you should go to opposite corners of the earth. I think I have been cursed with two sons more dysfunctional than Mr. Cain and Mr. Abel. I am perfectly willing to meet with him, Abba, if he will meet with me. Apparently he is willing. This is what I am told. I don't know. I don't talk with him any more than I talk with you. I am too busy at the moment trying to make my peace with God. Said Archibald, crunching on his toothpick out of hunger and nerves, and because Majid gave him the heebie-jeebies. I'll go and see if the food is ready, shall I? Yes, I'll do that. What am I picking up for you, Madge? A bacon sandwich, please, Archibald. Right. Right you are. Samad's face blew up like one of Mickey's fried tomatoes. So you mean to mock me, is that it? In front of my face, you wish to show me the kafir that you are. Go on then, munch on your pig in front of me. You are so bloody clever, aren't you, Mr. Smarty Pants, Mr. White-trousered Englishman with his stiff upper lip and his big white teeth? You know everything, even enough to escape your own judgment day. I am not so clever, Abba. No, no, you are not. You are not half as clever as you think. I don't know why I bother to warn you, but I do. You are on a direct collision course with your brother, Majid. I keep my ear to the ground. I hear Shiva talking in the restaurant, and there are others, Mo Hussein Ishmael, Mickey's brother, Abdul Colin and his son, Abdul Jimmy. These are only a few. There are many more, and they are organizing against you. Milat is with them. Your Marcus Chalfon has stirred a great deal of anger, and there are some, these green ties, who are willing to act. Who are crazy enough to do what they believe is right? Crazy enough to start a war? There aren't many people like that. Most of us just follow along once war has been announced. But some people wish to bring things to a head. Some people march onto the parade ground and fire the first shot. Your brother is one of them. All through this, as Samad's face contorted from anger to despair to near hysterical grins, Majid had remained blank, his face an unwritten page. You have nothing to say? This news does not surprise you? Why don't you reason with them, Abba, said Majid after a pause. Many of them respect you. You are respected in the community. Reason with them. Because I disapprove as strongly as they do, for all their lunacies. Marcus Chalfon has no right to do as he does. It is not his business, it is God's business. If you meddle with a creature, the very nature of a creature, even if it is a mouse, you walk into that arena that is God's creation. You infer that the wonder of God's creation can be improved upon. It cannot. Marcus Chalfon presumes. He expects to be worshipped when the only thing in the universe that warrants worship is Allah. And you are wrong to help him. Even his own son has disowned him. And so, said Samad, unable to suppress the drama queen deep within his soul, I must disown you. Ah, now one chips, beans, egg and mushroom for you, Sammy, my good man, said Archibald, approaching the table and passing the plate. And one omelette and mushrooms for me. And one bacon sandwich, said Mickey, who had insisted on breaking 15 years of tradition in bringing this one dish over himself. For the young professor. He will not eat that at my table. Oh, come on, Sam, began Archie gingerly. Give the lad a break. I say he will not eat that at my table. Mickey scratched his forehead. Stone me, we're getting a bit fundamentalist in our old age, ain't we? I said, as you wish, Abba, said Majid, with that same infuriating smile of total forgiveness. He took his plate from Mickey and sat down at the adjacent table with Clarence and Denzel. Denzel welcomed him with a grin. Clarence, look, see, here the young prince in white. I'm come to play domino. I just look in his eye, and I knew I'm playing domino. I'm an expert. Can I ask you a question, said Majid. Definitely, Guan. Do you think I should meet with my brother? I don't think me can say, replied Denzel after a spell of thought in which he had laid down a 5-domino set. I would say you look like a young fellow who can make up him own mind, said Clarence cautiously.
Do I? Majid turned back to his previous table where his father was trying studiously to ignore him, and Archie was toying with his omelette. Archibald, shall I meet with my brother or not? Archie looked guiltily at Samad and then back at his plate. Archibald, this is a very significant question for me, should I or not? Go on, said Samad sourly. Answer him. If he'd rather advice from two old fools and a man he barely knows than from his own father, then let him have it.
Well, should he?
Archie squirmed. Well, I can't... I mean, it's not for me to say, I suppose. If he wants, but then again, if you don't think...
Samad thrust his fist into Archie's mushroom so hard the omelette slithered off the plate altogether and slipped to the floor. Make a decision, Archibald. For once in your pathetic little life, make a decision.
Heads, yes, gasped Archie, reaching into his pocket for a 20-pence piece. Tails, no. Ready?
The coin rose and flipped as a coin would rise and flip every time in a perfect world, flashing its light and then revealing its dark enough times to mesmerize a man. Then, at some point in its triumphant ascension, it began to arc, and the arc went wrong, and Archibald realized that it was not coming back to him at all, but going behind him, a fair way behind him. And he turned with the others to watch it complete an elegant sweep towards the pinball machine and somersault straight into the slot. Immediately, the huge old beast lit up. The ball shot off and began its chaotic, noisy course around the labyrinth of swinging doors, automatic bats, tubes and ringing bells until, with no one to assist it, no one to direct it, it gave up the ghost and dropped back into the swallowing hole.
Bloody hell, said Archibald, visibly chuffed. What are the chances of that, eh?
A neutral place. The chances of finding one these days are slim, maybe even slimmer than Archie's pinball trick. The sheer quantity of shit that must be wiped off the slate if we are to start again as new. Race, land, ownership, faith, theft, blood, and more blood. And more. And not only must the place be neutral, but the messenger who takes you to the place, and the messenger who sends the messenger. There are no people or places like that left in North London. But Joyce did her best with what she had. First she went to Clara. In Clara's present seat of learning, a red brick university, southwest by the Thames, there was a room she used for study on Friday afternoons. A thoughtful teacher had loaned her the key. Always empty between 3 and 6. Contents, one blackboard, several tables, some chairs, 2 angle-poise lamps, an overhead projector, a filing cabinet, a computer. Nothing older than 12 years. Clara could guarantee that. The university itself was only 12 years old. Built on empty wasteland, no Indian burial grounds, no Roman viaducts, no interred alien spacecraft, no foundations of a long-gone church, just Earth, as neutral a place as anywhere. Clara gave Joyce the key, and Joyce gave it to Irie. But why me? I'm not involved.
Exactly, dear, and I am too involved, but you are perfect, because you know him, but you don't know him, said Joyce cryptically. She passed Irie her long winter coat, some gloves and a hat of Marcus's with a ludicrous bobble on the top. And because you love him, though he doesn't love you.
Yeah, thanks, Joyce. Thanks for reminding me.
Love is the reason, Irie.
No, Joyce, love's not the fucking reason.
Irie was standing on the Chalfont doorstep, watching her own substantial breath in the freezing night air. It's a four-letter word that sells life insurance and hair conditioner. It's fucking cold out here. You owe me one.
Everybody owes everybody, agreed Joyce and closed the door.
Irie stepped out into streets she'd known her whole life, along a route she'd walked a million times over. If someone asked her just then what memory was, what the purest definition of memory was, she would say this. The street you were on when you first jumped in a pile of dead leaves. She was walking it right now. With every fresh crunch came the memory of previous crunches. She was permeated by familiar smells. Wet wood chip and gravel around the base of the tree, newly laid turd underneath the cover of soggy leaves. She was moved by these sensations. Despite opting for a life of dentistry, she had not yet lost all of the poetry in her soul, that is, she could still have the odd Proustian moment. Note layers upon layers, though she often experienced them in periodontal terms. She got a twinge, as happens with a sensitive tooth or in a phantom tooth when the nerve is exposed, She felt a twinge walking past the garage where she and Milat, aged 13, had passed 150 pennies over the counter